Chapter 7, The Perfection of Perseverance, and the particular quality of this chapter has to do with joyful perseverance. The qualities of the translation, it's not just perseverance, which we sometimes interpret as struggle or forcing, but joyful effort, enthusiastic effort. The first few chapters, we established that the most important thing in life was to develop the vast, open, generous heart. And we looked to see how does one go about that. And we saw that first you have to stabilize your mind and be able to deal with all the different kinds of emotions that affect you and others negatively. So we went through how to work with antidotes to those and emotions and how to develop patience. And then we worked with how to develop mindfulness, how to be aware of what you're doing as you're doing it. So now, having established some sort of ability to control our body and our mind, and we're less tortured than we were, we can look at then how do you become skillful, right? Because now you're prepared and ready to become skillful, and how do you become joyfully skillful at opening your heart and benefiting others. So we've been comparing the chapters to the one short verse on bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is that quality of limitless compassion and loving kindness. And the little prayer that we say so often, bodhicitta, excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. So the next series of chapters are at may it ever increase higher and higher. So we've stabilized our mind. Now, how do we open our hearts? And the other thing I wanted to remind folks of, again, is there's a whole genre of literature in the Tibetan tradition called Lam Rim. It means the path. And all of those Lam Rim texts take each of the six perfections, and the chapters are organized by the six perfections, and they go deeply into each one. So you can look at the Lam Rim texts from lots of different lineages, lots of different great masters, and compare chapter by chapter. This teaches bodhicitta in this way. This lama in his commentary has a little nuance here. This lama is looking at perseverance in this way. And many of the chapters on the six perfections refer to this text because this text by Shantideva is one of the great texts on the six perfections. So you will find additional commentaries on these verses in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, the stages of the path, the lamp unto enlightenment. So again, just reminding you of these resources. So we start with, and this is so beautiful, thus with patience I will persevere, through zeal it is that I shall reach enlightenment. If no wind blows, then nothing stirs, and neither is there merit without perseverance. So what I found stunning about this chapter is it begins with, if no wind blows, nothing stirs. You know, we have to become the wind. Our perseverance becomes the wind, our sense of aspiration. But it ends with a verse that says, stirred by every breath of wind. Likewise, all I do will be achieved, enlivened by the movements of a joyful heart. So he's going to take us from, we're sitting here perhaps with not as much inspiration as we would like if no wind stirs, and by the end, every breath is the wind that propels our joyful heart. So that organization to me was just gorgeous from beginning to end. It goes from how to energize ourselves until we're never separated from practice at all, because it is so joyful and delightful for us to be practicing. I was mentioning to the folks who are here, we have a culture that talks a lot about burnout and talks a lot about overgiving. And so this is a really wonderful commentary on that as well, in terms of how does the delight and joy propel you with, rather than the sense of burden. How do we get out of that sense of burden and into the delight and joy? It's so much fun, this chapter. Again, it's Shantideva's pep talk. And so I'm reading it thinking, this is a great pep talk for me. And so I'm right into the pep talk kind of thing, and I'm, you know, hearing it in my own voice too. And what is interesting about this chapter, I think, is he's talking about mastery. How do we master something? What does it take to master something? And it made me reflect on the different things that I've mastered in the course of my life and how we have all mastered things. Like I think of my friend Corinne, who had never baked a pie, and then she decided she'd do a fundraiser for pies and baked 100 pies. We never knew she could never bake a pie because she's the pie master. Because the 100 pies turned her into a pie master. And many, many things in our lives, we have decided, oh, we'll go back to school. We decide we go back to school, we drop everything. All of a sudden, there's time and space for us to be back in school, right? We make the time and space. You know, I was thinking about my profession as a sculptor, how much fun it was and how each different material, in order to get to the mastery level, I had to first learn it and then spend 5 years in that particular material. 5 years to become a good wood carver. 5 years to become, you know, expert mold maker. So all these different things in life we have mastered, and we have arranged our lives, made decisions that this is something we'll do, and we went ahead and did it. So Shanti Dev is saying, okay, if we've decided that the vast open heart is the most important thing beyond all these other things, how do we master it, and how do we overcome the different kinds of neuroses that prevent us from mastering? The questions that I started looking at is, okay, we meet the Dharma, and all of a sudden there are 84,000 teachings, and particularly in the Tibetan tradition, we're introduced to Nundra right away, which is 100,000 prostrations. They're called the preliminary practices, and in the Drikung, they're 5 section. Each one is 100,000. And so all of a sudden, we go to overwhelm. We're barely in the Dharma, and we're overwhelmed. Why is it that that can seem overwhelming when other things don't seem overwhelming? When does our joy get lost in some of these things, and how do we reclaim the joy? These are the things he addresses. So verse 2, his heroic perseverance means delight in virtue. Its contrary may be defined as laziness, an inclination for unwholesome ways, despondency, and self-content. So I started really focusing on this delight, and the example is like a child playing. And I started thinking of all the wonderful masters and how so many of the masters thank everybody for coming to the talks and thank them for practicing, and they steer us away from any kind of guilt. And it's because they're trying to keep us focused on the delight of practice and the delight in learning about your own mind and the delight in shedding ignorance. So clearly we don't want to apply negative voices to our practice. So they define laziness as a mind that takes no joy in Dharma. So that's laziness, when you have no joy in practicing the Dharma. And then going into more detail, failure to thrive in learning and training, and inclination towards idleness. Attached to the unwholesome, yearning for sleep, not saddened by samsara, delight in samsaric activity, even boasting. So instead of being saddened by samsara, saddened by the confusion, that you take delight in samsara and you even say, I'm so great because I'm achieving this and this and this, even though that is not going to bring you the lasting happiness and the open heart that you so yearn for. An inclination to the unwholesome, and self-depreciation and defeatism. So the next series of verses are looking at those kinds of things. Why do we get sort of stuck? The first antidote is contemplating impermanence. And they say that impermanence is the door to the Dharma and the door to the practice. And he does go over it in every single chapter in one form or another. And yet again, here we have impermanence, more fun examples of impermanence. And this is really close to our hearts this season, because we had a friend here in the Sangha who had a sudden death. She got up in the morning, she was making her bed, and then she died. She wasn't there. And so there's that sense of a reminder. You know, she had a box full of small notebooks of all of her Dharma notes, and we had to burn them. You know, she died, and then that was it. So we don't know when we will die. We don't know if we'll awaken tomorrow. Shanti Deva continues with, don't you see how one by one death comes to claim your fellow men, and yet you slumber on so soundly like a buffalo beside its butcher? So it's like we're one of the cattle, and we're fast asleep, and our friend the farmer tomorrow is ready to feed his family. So we're placidly accepting life as opposed to seeing it could be short and we're not thinking about it. Death will be so quick to swoop upon you, gather merit until that moment comes. If you wait till that moment to banish laziness, there'll be no time, and what will you do? And then you'll be thinking to yourself, this I have not done, and this I'm only starting, and this I'm only halfway through. And then is the sudden coming of the Lord of Death, and oh, the thought, alas, I'm finished. So I put myself in Leela's shoes, you know, thinking, okay, if I woke up this morning and I'm making my bed, and all of a sudden I died, I would be thinking, oh my goodness, I haven't finished learning everything I wanted to learn. I haven't finished the open heart. I haven't finished the trainings that would get me there. So it is a very good reminder. One of the things I look to is some of the extraordinary Rinpoches. So I was remembering in India, the Rinpoches who wasted no time, absolutely no time. And there was this one young Rinpoche who I thought was quite an example. And I remember meeting him when he was about 15 years old. And he had hitchhiked on the back of a truck from Tibet, sneaking over the border to get to the teachings in India. And when we were in line waiting to go in the temple, he'd be saying mantras. Everybody else would be fooling around, chatting. And here he was, such a young person. He was just focused on the every single moment practicing. And then I saw him again 4 years later, and we asked him for teachings. He was already becoming such a great scholar. And someone would come in and ask a question, and while it was being translated, he would be practicing. You know, so there was no extra time in his life. Every minute was practicing. And then you see some of our great teachers like Garchen Rinpoche you go to visit. While things are being translated or while people at the table are being chatting, he has a smoke offering going, and he's always adding a little sage and cedar to the smoke offering, making offerings. So we look at these people who have a sense of every moment could be applied to the Dharma, to teaching. When I was working for Venerable Dahani and living over on her property, I would always see her light on late at night. You know, I know she was working for the Dharma and practicing. And every time I would drive her someplace, there's no small talk. It's just, you know, either, you know, what can we do to help things progress, or she would sit in meditation while I drove, you know. So there's this sense of learning from the people who don't take any moment of life for granted. Now, jumping a little bit, Shanti Deva's, the time you have now is not for sleep, you fool. to help get you out of bed. That was a little bit of 14. And then 16, we can go right to 16. Do not be downcast, but marshal all your strength. Take heart and be the master of yourself. Practice the equality of self and other. Practice the exchange of self and other. So in the chapters to come, he's going to focus more thoroughly on the equality of self and other and the exchange of self and other. And you recognize the exchange of self and other as the Tonglin training that we were doing this morning. So we have all of these trainings that help us look at our self-absorption. And so I'm going to read a quote from one of the commentaries. We have been wandering in samsara for limitless eons because we posit there is an I where there is not an I, a self where there is no self, and we make that self our sole object of affection. So that equality of self and other is a way of training yourself to see that at this moment, every single being alive doesn't want pain and does want happiness. Even an amoeba will move away from a needle to avoid pain. And so we start to see if every other being wants happiness in the same way that I want happiness, why do I so focus it gaining happiness for myself instead of widening our perspective for the happiness of all beings who are alive just like we are alive and want happiness just like we want happiness? And we'll go through this in more detail particularly in the next chapter. And you might start to think, well, I have children and I certainly want happiness for children, and I have family and I certainly want happiness for my family. But when we examine that, that happiness is an extension of me and mine. We want happiness for my family. We work to benefit my family. And the point of these practices is to dissolve all those barriers that we see all beings the same way we see our most beloved, our children, our partner, etc. What's interesting is that it's done in a very, very simple way. And the first step is just to say, okay, let's just think about that. Let's think about the fact that all beings want happiness just like myself. Is this true? You know, how do we begin to examine just that one simple thought? And I remember in the early years of studying with Venerable Dahani, I was studying in the Cherokee tradition for many, many years, and we would start off every single ceremony with, may we be doing this for all sentient beings. And you can see in the Buddhist tradition, we start out, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And at that time, I was an artist, and I realized just by repeating that simple beginning, that simple aspiration, it widened my perspective. So gradually over the years, my art changed from, I want to be rich and famous and well-known, to I want to do art in hospitals and for people with cancer and for hospice. And it was the force of just widening the perspective and becoming accustomed to the thought that without me even realized changed the way I thought about my entire life. We can look at the idea of reincarnation and the thought that if we've had many, many, many lives, zillions and zillions of lives, at some point every being, every animal, every bird, every being has been a relative of ours. So the my family becomes all beings. So how do we just test that out, sort of dip our toe into that? And then as we were doing this morning, the exchange of self and others is where you practice first by just imagining you're lifting the suffering from another being and extending to them your happiness. And we often start with a situation that's fairly simple, like if you're a mom and your child is very sick, you would naturally think, oh, if I could just take this cold from you for a day, I would do that for you, dear one. Can we get to that for all beings? So then as Shantideva is wont to do, just like us, he thinks of this, okay, I want to be able to open my art to all beings, but then he has a moment of fear. He goes, oh, but how could I become enlightened? And then he says to himself, don't excuse yourself with such despondency. The Buddhas who declare the truth have spoken and indeed proclaimed that if they bring forth the strength of perseverance, the very bees and flies and stinging gnats or grubs will find with ease enlightenment so hard to find. So we sometimes start to think, how could I possibly become enlightened? I'd have to go so far, do so much, lose entire fear in order to help and take responsibility for helping Syria, Sudan. How could I possibly do that? And he was saying, absolutely do not excuse yourself with despondency. All beings have Buddha nature. So we all have the potential. We have the potential to be the perfected heart that the Dalai Lama is today, the perfected heart that we witnessed in Nelson Mandela. So let's look at what are these different kinds of ideas that lead to the self-defeatism, that lead to the despondency, and let's go through them one by one. And so some of the verses are going to work with these ideas. And what I found interesting, in particularly this time in the commentary by Zygmunt Cantrell, was how he looked at the kind of neurotic fears we have that prevent us from taking on mastery. And the first one is, do we believe we're not capable? And that's why we look at Buddha nature. Yes, we have the potential, so we are capable. For instance, if I decided today I wanted to be a gold medal Olympic gymnast, not possible. I'm 63. I'm overweight. I never had any physical talent whatsoever. Not possible. But if, and we know what Olympians go through, even if I did that, not possible. But we have Buddha nature. So we actually are gifted with the potential. And if we did the training, he's saying that all the Buddhists have said, absolutely, yes, it's possible. So that's the first antidote. In thinking we are incapable, now we're getting back to the neurosis, have we pre-decided we're going to fail? Have we pre-decided it's not possible for us? And then why? Why are we doing that? One thing is, are we waiting to be inspired? Do we think that one day we'll wake up and we'll say, I can't wait to practice today, and I'm going to go into retreat tomorrow, and there's some dreamlike fantasy of what it would be like to be inspired to practice that we aren't experiencing, as opposed to understanding that the inspiration comes in the practice itself, and that as we practice, as we see our ignorance dropping away, sometimes it's like you're taking off a pair of glasses that made you see the world in a distorted way. All of a sudden you understand something, and then you're never confused about that particular thing again. Because you're practicing, you're inspiring yourself because your experience is showing you that you are changing, right? And so that is the inspiration. When we think of, oh, there are all these Tibetans in the picture and I'm supposed to be devoted to this lineage, I don't know any of these people. It's by reading the stories of how they became enlightened, the things that they did. Milarepa, who was the murderer, who then met a very severe, on the outward plane, teacher, but still became a Buddha. The devotion to the lineage comes from learning about the people and learning about the history. It doesn't come just magically, you know, by looking at the pictures. I was also thinking about the reality we're living in today in terms of the computer instant gratification. Are we starting culturally to have a misguided view of what effort is because we're used to things being so quickly accessible? I noticed when I was teaching that it became harder and harder to inspire students to take an idea and develop it further. In an art class, you bring an object to the teacher, and the teacher goes, oh, this is wonderful, I see this idea. Do it again, but this time emphasize this part of the idea. And then they come back, and you say, oh, it's getting better, now do it again, emphasizing this aspect of your idea. It's actually harder for people to understand that they want to make an effort, that by making an effort of exploring things, learning things, that they actually will learn more because things are so immediately changeably accessible in this day and age in terms of time. So we want to understand what effort is. And then Zigar Khantra Rinpoche was talking about sometimes we have the fantasy that if we go to a teaching, the teacher will do it for us, that it's like a concert. If you go hear the Dalai Lama, you open your heart, you open your mind, something magical will happen. And that's thinking that someone is going to, you know, magically do something for us instead of us going through the step-by-step process. And another one is, do we think we're going to get the teacher's approval? So in sanghas, when we start getting closer to a teacher, if we can only motivate ourselves by thinking, now the teacher will like me, I'll become the favorite student, that's, again, not a sustaining way of motivating yourself. So that's like eating for someone else as opposed to eating because you're hungry. And then, perhaps because he comes from a different culture, he was saying that if we are overpraised for small steps, do we need applause for practice? Do we need to make ourselves self-important? Do we need to think that we're doing it for others in a misunderstanding of the bodhisattva ideal because that makes us seem to ourselves or others good? You see what I mean? I'm doing this. I'm going to go bring you a bowl of soup because you're sick because I'm such a nice neighbor, as opposed to I'm so happy to do this for you. See what I mean? So he's looking at all our different neuroses and helping us to see that we need to marshal this enthusiasm for ourselves so that we can practice knowing that it's going to benefit others, trusting that it's going to benefit others, seeing how it's benefiting ourselves and others in a healthy way. So looking at ourselves really without the rose-colored glasses on and seeing those neuroses, then he says, okay, this is human. These are the different kinds of confusions. Now, how do we teach ourselves the Dharma in these situations? How do we apply the Dharma creatively to become unstuck? And he's going to take us through a series of qualities and help us remember that really what is fun and exhilarating fun is learning how to benefit others. The other things that we associate as being fun are just momentary and passing. So we talk about the four allies in our training, the armor of diligence, gathering our strength, marshaling our strength, mindfulness, and vigilant in introspection, so we're watching what we're doing and our motivation, and again, it comes back to joy, striving with joy. So, verse 19, able to distinguish good from ill, if I, by birth and lineage of humankind, devote myself to bodhisattva training, why should I not gain the state of Buddhahood? That I must give my life and limbs alarms and frightens me if you say this, your terror is misplaced, confused. You fail to see what is hard and easy. So one of the things that we look at in terms of the great bodhisattvas is that certain stages close to enlightenment, the bodhisattvas would just simply offer their body. There's a famous story of the Buddha before he was enlightened where there were these starving tiger cubs. And he was walking with his brothers on the path. He saw them and he just jumped and offered his body. His compassion for the starving animals was so great. With joy and delight, he jumped. And so we're going, again, Shanti Deva is quaking with fear a little bit, saying, maybe I have the potential to become a Buddhahood, but if the training means offering your body, how could I possibly do that? It's terrifying. So then he's saying, well, if you're thinking like that, you're actually not thinking in a clear way, because look at all the different lives you've had. You know, at different lives, you've been the one in Sudan. In different lives, you've been the one that's in Syria. Your body's been cut up, been murdered, been maimed, you've been blinded, all these things, and you haven't accomplished anything in those lives in terms of getting enlightened. So why are you afraid of that when you've been through it for no point, as opposed to letting it terrify you now when it's going to be extraordinary, compassionate kind of giving, and how that's completely different? The hardships, now at 22, suffered on the path to Buddhahood are different, for their span is limited and are likened to the pain of an incision made to cure the harm of hidden ailments. This is a reflection that now any hardship is going to be for enlightenment, to benefit oneself and all sentient beings, that it's going not life after life being in the middle of Syria, but now it's a life leading to the capacity to benefit beings and to make joyful offerings. And it's an example of Buddha as the doctor and the Dharma as medicine. To unterrify us a little more, is a later verse says, you only offer something like your body when it's the same as giving a cabbage, when you have no longer any distinction that it's a difficult thing to do or painful. It's, oh, you need a cabbage, here's a cabbage. Oh, you need something, here's what you need in this moment. You're prepared for that. You start in very, very, very simple, gradual ways. But before he gets to that reassuring verse, he's talking about, let's say there were a little pain on the path. It's like going to the doctor. If you got diagnosed with cancer tomorrow, right, you would immediately go to the doctor, and if the doctor said, it's going to be a little painful, it's going to be difficult, but it's going to cure you, I'm going to give you chemotherapy, which is poison, you go, oh, I'll take the poison. You know, I want to live longer, I'll take the poison. If the doctor said, well, it's going to be even more painful, you need bone marrow transplant, go, oh, I know it's going to be hard, but I'll do it. You know, I want to keep living. I still want pleasure in my life. I will do this. So he's showing you that, okay, you would accept something difficult, a difficult instruction for the doctor who's going to heal your body. So don't be worried about difficulties that are going to change your mind completely and open your heart completely and bring you a sustaining and lasting peace and joyful state of mind and compassionate state of mind. Then we get to the reassuring verse. And yet the Supreme Healer does not use, like the doctors, these common remedies. With antidotes of extreme tenderness, he soothes away intense and boundless suffering. So it's the extreme tenderness. He goes, first, just think about one little idea that you could have a vast and compassionate heart, that you have the capacity for that. Think about giving a little food off your plate. We make offerings once a day to the spirit beings, and historically there was a starving demoness who needed food for her children. We make an offering for them. So first we just start with just a little food off our plate. Then we think about giving cans of food to the food pantry. Then we think of anybody who needs food who's hungry today, come here, eat at my house. So he's saying, we're just going to go so slowly and so gradually, you're going to be ready for each step. Our guide instructs us to begin by giving food or other charities that later, step by step, the habit once acquired, we may donate our very flesh. When one has the view that sees equality between one's body and the food one gives, why then what hardship can there be in giving up, relinquishing one's very flesh? When your mind makes no distinction whatsoever, admittedly it's much later, then there's no hardship to you, right? It's the same as that little portion of food from your plate. So you're not asked to do that before then. You're only asked to do the little pinch of food from your plate right now. Verse 28, merit is the true cause of body's ease. Accumulating merit, all the virtues you do, lead to your body's sense of ease in life after life. While happiness of mind is brought through training. So your personal happiness, what you think, what you feel, comes from training your mind. Your happiness, both happiness of mind and a feeling of ease in your body, comes from all of these different trainings and acts that you're doing, that you're starting at small habits that over time become big habits. What can sadden those who have compassion, who linger in samsara for the sake of beings? Accumulated merit, when we look at the great, great teachers, like I was talking today about His Eminence Garchen Rinpoche, who's teaching, even though his eyes are puffed, he can't read anymore, because he's such a great practitioner, his attendants are saying that a normal person could not function with the level of difficulty of his eyes, both in terms of pain. But he doesn't mentally experience the pain as a hardship because his habit, through lifetime after lifetime, is not to focus on himself, but to find the happiness and the sense of ease in terms of how can he uplift others. So it's a different situation for the bodhisattvas. Once they have achieved an enlightenment, they're not experiencing the pain of samsara because their joy of helping others so far surpasses, which describes the bodhisattvas, or the great, great compassion teachers. For mounted on the horse of bodhicitta that puts to flight all mournful weariness, who could ever be dejected riding such a steed from joy to joy? 31. The forces that secure the good of beings are aspiration, firmness, joy, and moderation. Aspiration grows through fear of suffering and contemplation of the benefits to be attained. So these are the four strengths in practice: firmness, joy, moderation. Aspiration, firmness, joy, and moderation. We talked a little bit about aspiration, the wishing that all beings be free from suffering and reach enlightenment. And the second one, firmness, is a very important one. It's not going back on what one has begun. And it has the qualities of self-confidence and steadfastness, the capacity to stay. So this steadfastness is really important in meditation. And it's something that Annie Pema emphasizes a lot. I'm really struck by that. When you're meditating in their system, the Shambhala, every New Year's they give you a calendar with every single day marked off so you can check, yes, I've meditated that day. there's a tradition of writing your teacher once a month and telling them about your meditation every day, because they're trying to help people cultivate this steadfastness. Whatever is going on in your life, even for a few minutes, you're going to stay in meditation. You're going to sit with your mind. You're going to befriend your mind. No matter, you know, if your mind is torturing yourself that day, even for one session, you're going to stay with your mind. So that capacity to just sit and allow yourself to observe your mind and then to come to the stability of focus on your breath. I'm getting a divorce, but still I can do this. I'm being evicted from my house. Still I can do this. I'm moving tomorrow. Still I can do this. Allows you to, over time, realize there's nothing that can separate you from meditation. There's no state of your mind that's too horrible, too fearful, too awful that you can't sit with it just for a few minutes. So that's really important, particularly when you're in crisis. And then joy, finding a way to take pleasure in the process. And then the third one is very interesting, moderation and relaxation. Excuse me, the fourth one. It's not that you have to force yourself with a harshness to stay in meditation. You want that joy to be present, but if your mind is so tortured that your session is totally unproductive, just doing a little bit is good. If you're so tired you can't possibly go one more step, often when we're doing the protector practices at night, Barbara and I are so tired, we just do the short version. Realizing that we're so tired that we want to cultivate the habit, make sure there is a presence of that practice every day, but realize that our bodies can't sustain a long practice in that moment. So with joy, we can do the short practice. With moderation, then we know we have the energy to come back again to it tomorrow. Now he's going back into encouraging himself, giving himself the pep talk again, 33. Thus the boundless evils of myself and others, I alone must bring them all to nothing, even though a single of these ills may take unnumbered ages to exhaust. Okay, I have the potential. Even if it takes me the rest of this life, I'm going to understand how to have patience and not be angry. Even if it takes me the rest of this life, I'm going to learn to look at every being as a beloved and not have enemies on one side and friends on the other. Even if it takes me the rest of this life, even if it takes me many lives, I'm going to undo my confusion so I can help others undo their confusion. All virtues for my own and others' sake, even though they may be many, I must now accomplish, even if for each I must endeavor for unnumbered ages. He goes back into the things he hasn't done. Acquaintance I have never made with even a part of such a fabulous quality of someone who could, you know, achieve enlightenment. If I haven't made acquaintance with keeping my temper for 1 minute, then why am I wasting time in trivial pursuits? I have this precious human life. Why should I not devote it to learning how to keep my temper? And so I will aspire and tend to virtue and steep myself with great devotion. And with the method stated in the Vajravaya, I will train in confident assurance. The teaching he's referring to is a teaching that talks about the sun shining, illuminating the entire world, regardless of the blindness of beings and mountain shadows. So with the method stated, you want to learn to have a compassionate heart, even if it's not being received by some, even if people are denigrating you, saying you're a fool. Just like the sun shining, you're going to open your heart. Now he's getting really practical. Okay, I'm going to do this. How am I going to do this? 47. Let me at first consider my resources to start or not to start accordingly. For it is better not to start at all than to begin and retrace my steps. So let's say someone has the aspiration to become a nun. We say, wonderful, that's great. first take temporary vows. Investigate. See if it's something that is going to be good for you and make you happy. Then you will have accomplished that. If you give back your vows because it's not right for you, you will have accomplished your goal of saying, for this period of time, I'm going to do it. You will have set a pattern in life of a success. So he's saying, okay, let's start with creating patterns for success. Let's look at our resources. We want to build a monastery. 30 years ago, Venerable said, oh, we should have a monastery. We were in our 30s. We had never saved for a house, barely paying rent. The idea of starting a monastery, whoa. So we say, okay, now what would be a good first step? Let's build a stupa. And we go, yeah, let's build a stupa. We had never built a stupa. I didn't know what a stupa was. I had no idea. So we said, okay, our resources, let's fundraise for $10,000 to $20,000 before we're fundraising for $1 million. Let's learn this one thing before we have to learn this giant thing. So we looked at ourselves, our capabilities, our resources, and then we had to say, okay, this is a group of 10 people sitting here. Who is going to say, you know, we will take this on no matter what happens? You know, even if half the group departs, we'll take it on. So that's the kind of quality he's asking. He's asking to look at, how do you start patterns in your life? How do you start a pattern for success so that each step you take, you complete, and then you're ready to take the next step? So that's very practical, right? Totally practical information. For acting thus, if you have to stop and not complete something, for acting thus, the pattern will return in later lives, and sin and pain will grow, and all other actions will be left undone, or else will bear a meager fruit. So if you set a pattern of not completing what you set out to do, that pattern will increase. And we want to, in our aspiration for enlightenment, to start patterns that will increase, that we can do successfully. 49, action, the afflictions and ability. Three things to which my pride should be applied. I will do this, I myself alone. These words define my pride of action. When we're ready to start, when we're ready to take as a start something we feel we are prepared for, like this course on the Bodhisattva, many, many of us are completing all 10 chapters. I'm proud that I've studied this text. I'm proud that I've completed all of the, and I will do it. If something happened tomorrow, if for some reason the course stopped, I'll still read all the rest of the chapters. Do you see what I mean? You're starting. No matter what happens, you will complete the task. Now I'm skipping to verse 63. Like those who take great pleasure in their games, the bodhisattvas in their every deed will feel the greatest joy, exhilaration, pleasure that will never fade or pass. So when we start this creation of habits and patterns, of patterns that we complete, it grows into just like children in a game. We are doing it because it is so much fun that we absolutely delight in doing it. And the bodhisattvas that we see are feeling that great pleasure in all of their Dharma activities. So if we look at His Holiness Chetsen Rinpoche, I remember asking him one of the times he came here after the event was over, and I was so tired. He decided he would take a small group of us out to lunch. And thinking, you know, all I was doing was arranging one event, and here he was going from event to event and had done all of these incredible activities. I said, well, how do you do this? You know, like, how do you get the physical energy to do something like this task, giant task of, you know, clearly he's someone who is seeing I myself will take on all the people in the world and create the resources for them to become enlightened. He pointed to his forehead and he goes, see, I don't have any wrinkles. I don't worry. He was going from joy to joy to accomplish all of these tasks. And then later in life, his body did wear out a little, and he sort of had a physical collapse, and he rested. and he rested for 2 years. And now he's back to worldwide activities again. So when he needed to rest, he rested. And then when he was back to the joy of accomplishing, that's what he was doing. There wasn't the stress and the burden quality. It was, I set into motion this karma by doing virtue after virtue after virtue, and it unfolds because the merit and karma to create it are propelling it. Shanti David then asks us to think again, verse 65. And since I never have enough of pleasure, honey on a razor's edge, how could I have enough of merit, fruits of which are happiness and peace? So I go back again to chocolate. Many times in life, how could I ever have enough of chocolate? Now, all these years later, if I keep having chocolate, it'll be diabetes, right? So it's honey on a razor's edge. What I think is bringing me pleasure actually could, you know, incapacitate me. So if what really is going to bring me pleasure is letting go of my ignorance, learning, training, doing things for other. If I think that I could never have enough chocolate, why am I not thinking I could never have enough merit? I could never have enough of these wonderful activities. I need to apply my intelligence to what is really pleasure and really happiness, and let that be how I apply that sense of never having enough. Then he shows you what you should be like. The elephant, tormented by the noonday sun, will dive into the waters of a lake. And sometimes it says a muddy pond, which I like even better. And likewise, I must plunge into this work that I might bring it to completion. And Emma is this elephant, this teacher, like that every time I take her for a walk. Emma is a water dog. And the second she sees water, she's straining. She's pulling me on the leash towards the water. Anytime she sees the water, she would jump in. And that's the kind, and out of sheer pleasure, right? Total pleasure. That's the way we want to feel about practice. That's the way we want to feel about coming to meditation, coming to teaching. Just like Emma straining to jump in that water, we want to strain to jump into practice. That follows, if impaired by weakness or fatigue, I'll lay the work aside, the better to resume, and I will leave tasks completed, anticipating the work to come. And then jumping to verse 71, be like a frightened man holding a brimming oil jar in his hand and menaced by a swordsman saying, spill one drop and you shall die. This is how the discipline holds themselves. And I think this was probably a common story of holding the, you know, someone having to carry oil. You know, if you were a prisoner, they would say, okay, if you can go through the circus holding this oil, we'll pardon you and you won't get the death sentence. So it must have had some cultural application. But one thing we can think of is slightly milder. We don't have quite the swordsman image, but driving. If we think of when we're driving, we are always aware of where the other lane is, right? And where the other side of the road is. So we have mindfulness, a conscious mindfulness, but we're not necessarily aware that we're putting that much effort into having the mindfulness of where the other lane is and where the side of the road is. We want to develop that continuous watchfulness to see, am I working with a good motivation in everything I do? Am I paying attention to what I'm doing so that we don't stray into telling little lies here or there, little white lies, into, you know, grabbing the chocolate, all those kinds of things. But even more, the Bodhisattva training can help us see absolutely everything as a way of gaining merit. So you're walking from here into the library. As I pass through this door, as I open the door, may I open the door for all beings. We put a lot of signs around the monastery just helping people think about things. If you're going upstairs, may I bring all beings into the enlightened realms. If you're going downstairs, may I go into the hell realms to bring people compassion. May I eat so that all the different beings that manifest as cells of my body, may they be fed. There's a way to think of continuously all of your activities in a way of benefiting beings, and that is a way of accumulating merit day and night, even in your sleep. Actually, there was a period in one retreat where I was having these terrible nightmares. I was able to start in the dream, start facing the monster type beings and say, actually, we don't have to do this. Let's sit down and talk about Dharma. And it actually cured the nightmares. Then Shantideva encourages an absolutely vigilant attitude. As such a man would leap in fright to find a snake coiled in his lap, if sleep and sluggishness beset me, I will instantly dispel them. If you had something frightening fall in your lap and you come bright awake, you know, you can, when you start to find yourself sort of drifting in life or in practice, immediately dispel them. Every time then that I fail, I reprove and vilify myself, thinking long that by whatever means such faults in the future will no longer occur. So this is reflecting his personality. He finds it effective, you know, if he is failing to vilify himself. That may not necessarily be helpful for you. You might want to be more gentle with it, but there are wonderful stories about, there's the story of Geshe Ben, who's at this fancy dinner, and everybody leaves the room, and he wants, I'm going to say chocolate, he wants more chocolate. So he puts his hand in the dish, and he goes, "You thief, you thief!" People come running out, and it was only him trying to grab more chocolate. Whatever works for you. Again, as I was saying at the beginning, using the Dharma to help you creatively become unstuck for whatever particular neurosis affects you. Then the last few verses, at all times and in any situation, mindfulness will be my constant habit. This will be the cause whereby I am to meet with teachers and fulfill the proper tasks. By all means, then, before I start this work, that I might have the strength sufficient to the task, I will reflect on these words of mindfulness and lightly rise to what is to be done. Lightly rise, joyfully rise. Oh no, I've got to do this. Lightly. The fruition, the lichen, the moss, hanging on a tree, wafts to and fro, stirred by every breath of wind. Likewise, all I do will be achieved, enlivened by the movements of a joyful heart. So lichen or a flag that's just blown by the wind, every wind that blows, blows it. All the practice, all the ways of benefiting beings, naturally, effortlessly, not with a sense I'm going to benefit this person, but just because the wind is blowing, I am benefiting, or actually just because the wind is blowing, benefiting, not the I or the other, enlivened by the movements of a joyful heart.